Good morning. My name is John Walk, and I am counsel for the environmental petitioners. Seated with me at counsel's table are Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Sims. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I plan to focus on the Section 112F2 and arbitrary and capricious arguments in our brief, resting on the briefs for the Section 112D6 arguments, unless, of course, this court has any questions. In the challenge actions, EPA undertook residual risk and technology reviews for the air toxic standards for organic chemical plants. EPA failed to revise the standards, failed to impose further controls, and failed to reduce cancer or non-cancer risk from these facilities, instead asserting that maximum lifetime cancer risk to the maximally exposed individual of 100 in 1 million were, quote, acceptable. In doing so, EPA violated the plain language of Section 112F2A of the Clean Air Act, which says in the relevant third sentence of that section, which appears on page 16 of the statutory addendum to petitioner's opening brief, that if following adoption of subsection 112D standards for air toxics, EPA finds that cancer risk of 1 in 1 million or greater to the maximally exposed individual are present, then EPA, quote, shall promulgate standards.
What's the purpose of the other sentences in the statutory section, if your interpretation is correct?
The other sentences govern environmental effects. They govern non-cancer effects. And the first sentence.
Where do you get the distinction between cancer and non-cancer effects out of the language of the statute?
Well, Congress proceeded with a general instruction, which is to review all residual risk standard, all air toxic standards for their residual risk in the first sentence, and then proceeded to adopt an ample margin of safety standard, which covers health generally. But then Congress drilled down further in the third sentence and specified that for cancer risk greater than 1 in 1 million, EPA shall promulgate standards.
Shall promulgate standards to do what?
Shall promulgate standards to reduce risk to the 1 in 1 million level.
But that's not what it says. That's not what it says.
In order for this court to remand.
Correct. That's not what it says.
That is not what this says, Judge Silberman. Correct. In order for this court to remand the matter to EPA, we believe that the court need only find that EPA failed to promulgate standards under this subsection to address the cancer risk. There are three clauses of that third sentence that are rendered meaningless and surplusage.
Wait a minute. I don't understand. Are you saying that EPA would comply with the statute if they promulgated standards which do not reduce to less than 1 in 1 million?
It is our reading that the standards EPA must adopt under F2A must reduce risk to 1 in 1 million.
But that's not what the statute says.
However, in the alternative, if the court is not prepared to say to what level of risk standards must reduce risk, nonetheless, EPA failed to comply with the statute by failing to adopt standards at all.
Wait a minute, counsel. That sounds a little peculiar. They have to adopt standards, but we don't have no idea what those standards should be.
The standards must reduce risk in order to give any meaning whatsoever to this third sentence. That reading is reinforced by the legislative history.
Reduce risk to?
That question is one that this court can decide to address or not. As we indicated, we do not believe the sentence makes sense if it would allow EPA.
Counsel, does it make sense if it says you must reduce risk to some level, but we don't know what it is?
Well, that's why we believe that Congress used the 1 in 1 million threshold. If I may use an example to illustrate our view, if an individual lived next to one facility that posed a risk of 2 in 1 million under one air toxic standard and lived next to a facility that posed a risk of 100 in a million under another air toxic standard, we believe EPA must reduce risk. It doesn't make sense in our view that Congress would have required risk to be reduced to 1 in 1
instance,
but to 99 in another.
You say it doesn't make sense, and you refer to the legislative history, but it seems to me that your position upsets the legislative compromise that was reached and takes the Senate version of the bill as opposed to the final version of the compromise that was reached.
The origins of the 1 in 1 million standard were the Senate version to govern carcinogens. The origins of the remaining portions of the bill, the ample margin of safety, were the House. But it's perfectly coherent to read those in a complementary manner to require the 1 in 1 million standard
to govern carcinogens. Okay, but you brought up the legislative history, and the sponsors and people who spoke on the bill at the time recognized that the final compromise rejected the bright line standard for both carcinogens and non-carcinogens.
With all due respect, Judge Kavanaugh, that is not correct. The statement of the Senate managers, Senator Baucus, Senator Durenberger, Senator Chafee, answered Judge Silverman's question by indicating that those standards must tighten the standards when cancer risk greater than 1 in 1 million were present, must reduce risk. And as I said,
theoretically, under your view, the EPA would have complied with that statute if they had reduced the risk to 1 and 99.
As I said,
you with me?
Yes, I understand the question.
Instead of going down to one in a million, if they're at 100 in a million, if they'd gone to 99 in a million, that would have complied with you. That's your view of the statute. That would have been legal.
No, because we indicate in our brief and believe that 1 in 1 million is the required standard. However,
now you're coming back to the point of saying that your case depends on our reading that third sentence as an obligation to go down to 1 in 1 million.
No, the court could still rule in our favor and remand to EPA if they found.
And if EPA said, okay, under that theory, we'll go to 1 and 99.
That would be
99 in a million. That would be legal.
That would be a question for EPA to evaluate on remand.
Well, it's a question of the statute means. Is that your position that 99 in a million would be okay?
It is not.
Your position is it has to go to 1 in a million.
That is correct. But
so then you're back to the point that the statute doesn't say that. It says you promulgate standards, but doesn't say the obvious point. If you were correct, it would say the administrator shall promulgate standards under this subsection that bring it down to 1 in a million.
It could say that, but
it has to if you're right.
I don't believe that to be the case, but what I would like to emphasize is that EPA failed to promulgate standards at all, so the court should remand the matter to EPA for failing to promulgate standards under this subsection.
And what do we tell them then? What's the standard they should promulgate?
Well, I believe it's within this court's discretion either to indicate that the standard is one for EPA to determine on remand. We, of course, would like the court to indicate that the standard should require risk reduction to 1 in 1 million. But as the Supreme Court in the Massachusetts versus EPA, for example, case did, they found that there was a facial violation of the statute, remanded the matter to EPA without dictating the outcome of the subsequent rulemaking. I believe all of those options are available to this court. But it is clear from the three subclauses, the 1 in 1 million standard, the under this subsection standard, and the shall promulgate language in the F2A sentence at issue, that EPA has rendered those surplusage and provides no coherent meaning for their role in the statute whatsoever.
How can it seriously be argued that this is a clear statute? How can it be seriously argued that this isn't ambiguous, particularly with this last third clause with this dangling notion at the end? How could anybody seriously contend that this is clear language? Put aside the legislative history that my colleague points out, which I think is very strong for the proposition that there was this one of these classic congressional compromises in which the language, in which they take part of the Senate bill and part of the House bill, and it looks like a salad. How can you take the position that this is clear language?
To be sure, the court would need to credit the structure of the third sentence in order to side with our 1 in 1 million language. However, we do believe that the statute is clear in finding a violation by EPA in failing to promulgate under this subsection and under this court's decision in Chenery.
It's not like they didn't act. You're putting a lot on the phrase promulgate the standards. I mean, they engaged in a rulemaking and they said things are fine. There hadn't been any great technological breakthroughs, and ample margin of safety is provided. Why isn't that at least consistent with the language of an ambiguous statute? And if it is, obviously you lose, right?
Shall promulgate standards is used throughout the Clean Air Act to refer to the adoption or establishment of standards in sections 110, 11, 12, 307. by the same token, Congress uses...
Did you say they need to promulgate new standards?
In each of those instances...
They're saying they need to act, and they acted here, right?
Congress says when they want EPA to publish something in the Federal Register, they use that language, 307B1. When they want EPA to conduct rulemaking, they use that term, 202K. They did not say that here. They said promulgate standards. And we believe that it makes no sense to sweep aside an entire statutory program that would take 10 years to implement for 100 source categories because EPA urges that readoption of a subsection D standard is sufficient to satisfy a duty to promulgate standards under subsection F. We don't believe that Congress intended that. If I may have time to turn to my arbitrary and capricious arguments, what I'd like to point out there is that this is a case in which EPA engaged in fundamentally inconsistent analysis and explanation, as well as a failure to consider important factors that EPA itself said needed to be considered. I'd like to point to just two quick examples in the remaining time. EPA said that inorganic hazardous air pollutants needed to be considered. They utterly failed to consider those cancer effects of inorganic hazardous air pollutants. We believe that is arbitrary. Facility cluster effects. EPA said that the more facilities that pose risk and toxics to an individual, the more risk, a sensible proposition. Yet EPA ignored a greater number of facilities than it considered in clusters of facilities in Houston.
But they did have a response to that, did they not?
Their response was that they said two internally inconsistent things, Judge Silberman. They said, well, we believe the maximum risk are posed to the fence line individual. At the same time, they said additional risk are posed by facilities on either side of the maximum exposed individual. And with 28 facilities that were ignored and 25 considered, we believe that that is arbitrary and submit for the court. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Galteri from the Department of Justice for US EPA. With me at council table this morning is Michael Thrift from EPA's Office of General Counsel. Petitioners raised three issues challenging EPA's 1994 emission standards for the synthetic organic chemical manufacturing industry. And those standards are known as LAHAN, and that's what I'll refer to them as. The first two issues concern petitioners' untenable interpretations of Clean Air Act Sections 112F2 and 112D6. First, petitioners claim that EPA was required to set a residual risk emission standard.
I don't think they are even talking about D6 this morning.
They haven't, Your Honor.
Now, why don't you focus on what they're focusing on this morning?
Certainly. With regard to the 112F2 argument, petitioners claim that EPA was required to set a residual risk emission standard that reduces lifetime cancer risk below 1 in 1,000,000. However, the text of the statute, Section 112F2, and its legislative history make clear EPA's reasonable interpretation that residual risk standards under Section 112F2 are to provide one and only one substantive standard, and that's an ample margin of safety to protect public health, consistent with EPA's pre-1990 interpretation of that provision, this court's decision in en banc decision in the vinyl chloride case, and most importantly, EPA's benzene NESHAP regulation, which articulated EPA's view on remand from vinyl chloride of the what is an ample margin of safety to protect public health.
What about his argument that you're required to promulgate standards and you didn't promulgate standards?
Well, Judge Griffith, I think we see it very much in line with the question that you asked regarding did EPA act? EPA did act. The statute requires EPA to promulgate standards. EPA reads that as requiring it with regard to carcinogenic sources of hazardous air pollutants as undertaking rulemaking to make its ample margin of safety determination. That is distinct from the first sentence of the statute with regard to non-carcinogenic hazardous air pollutants, where EPA can make its ample margin of safety decision, but if it decides that an ample margin of safety is provided, there's no requirement there that do that through rulemaking with all that that entails. So there is an added measure of stringency in the statute, which is the requirement to make this decision on the record through rulemaking pursuant to the requirements of Section 307D. You know, EPA acted in this regard. EPA did it on the record. EPA presents it all to the public, and it's there available for judicial review.
But did they promulgate standards?
Well, here, the promulgation consists of taking what was a Section 112D technology standard and reviewing it under the requirements of the ample margin of safety under Section 112F, making the determination that the ample margin of safety is met, and then by determining that, EPA has established a residual risk standard under Section 112F.
Your position is you re-promulgated.
Re-promulgated, re-adopted. There may be some ministerial function that you could point to, some language as to whether EPA said we now deem this a 112F standard, but we think that the Federal Register notice and the action taken through rulemaking does establish that, and that that constitutes promulgation of a new standard, this time under the residual risk provision.
Well, looking at the legislative history, what about Congressman Waxman's view as to what the third sentence meant?
Congressman Waxman's view, first of all, is reflected in a post-enactment law review article that the petitioners refer to as legislative history, which obviously isn't legislative history
We call that legislative future.
Well, it's something, but it's not legislative history, to be sure. And we directed the court to an abundance of legislative history that sees things completely differently than Congressman Waxman does after the fact. I mean, I think that's a statement of what he wishes it to be. That Senate proposal walked into conference as a requirement to eliminate risks to 1 in 1 million or 1 in 10,000. It, in fact, had two standards. What came out was not strong language like that. There was triggering language that says whenever it's 1 in 1 million, EPA shall do this and that. It's not the standard at all, and it's very different.
All of which illustrates the perils of legislative history.
Well, except that the compelling legislative history is the conference report. We go from the lowest on the food chain, which is a law review article from Congressman Waxman, to the highest on the food chain, which is the conference report.
And you're saying it's low because it's a law review article, not because it's...
Well,
no, why don't you just stick with the fact that it's not legislative history, rather than you don't want us to conclude that Congressman Waxman's views are of bottom of the food chain, do you?
No, well, I appreciate that, Your Honor. I think that is the important point, that it's not legislative history at all. But what is legislative history is the conference report. And the conference report states very clearly, subsection F2 is also linked to the recently promulgated NESHAP for benzene, which sets out the appropriate policy for regulating non-threshold, that's carcinogenic pollutants. But you know, when the conference report says the appropriate policy is to apply the benzene NESHAP for carcinogens, I don't know what stronger legislative history you have. And then you continue on, and the legislative history discusses specifically the vinyl chloride decision that was implemented by the benzene NESHAP, and it provides the citation to the benzene NESHAP itself, which of course made its way into the statute in F2B. And let's not also forget that there's a parenthetical that appears twice in F2A, which says, in accordance with this section prior to November 15th, 1990, that parenthetical appears twice, and the exact same language again appears in F2B, where the statute then goes on to specifically reference the benzene NESHAP.
What about his arbitrary and capricious argument?
With regard to the risk assessment, the 2 points, I'll focus first on the 2 points that he raises with regard to inorganic HAPs. The first being, it's inaccurate to say that EPA did not consider the cancer effects of the inorganic HAP. EPA performed what it called a whole facility screening level assessment using national emissions inventory data. That data included organic emissions and inorganic emissions from these facilities. And EPA used that as a screening level assessment to determine whether there were other things that it should be considering in its primary risk assessment, which was based on actual facility data that was gathered. The residual risk assessment at table 8-9 and at pages 8-9 and 8-10 speaks specifically about EPA's review of the cancer risks from those facilities. EPA identified 12 facilities with cancer risks that caused EPA to give it greater consideration. And the table at table 8-9 identifies two carcinogenic inorganic hazardous air pollutants, arsenic and chromium, that EPA considered. So it's simply inaccurate to say that EPA didn't consider that factor. And what EPA determined in that screening level assessment was that as to those facilities, the chromium and arsenic were not coming from sources regulated by this, by the HON, by this emission standard. So EPA deemed that it wasn't necessary to review it any further.
What about your allegedly cavalier approach to clusters?
The facility cluster issue, again, EPA considered it. We discussed in our brief and have in the record a discussion of how EPA addressed the question of facility clusters. There were, in the data that EPA had before it, 13 facility clusters. One of those clusters included 25 facilities. The petitioners contend it should have included more, but it included at least 25. That's a pretty representative data set. That's a lot of facility clusters to consider. And from that data, EPA made the determination that the cluster effect, whatever it may be, appears to be driven by the facility nearest to that individual, and that there doesn't seem to be a difference in the outcome if you consider other facilities. That was EPA's judgment. It's a technical judgment. EPA is entitled to the highest degree of deference on that in its risk assessment. The same goes, obviously, for the inorganic HAP, and there are other objections
to the risk
assessment.
Let me ask you a question which counsel did not raise this morning, but does raise in his brief. Why don't you use your Why didn't EPA use its authority to demand greater information from companies? Why do you use this representative sample? And counsel argues that the people who are going to respond to that are people who are less guilty or less concerned about their vulnerability. It's a reasonable argument, isn't it?
Well, if I can take your first point, or your second point first, the data don't indicate that EPA that the data were only from the lower emitting facilities. The data were from came from 104 facilities at a range of less than 10 tons per year and greater than 660 tons per year. And I believe that intervener's brief has an analysis of sort of weighting how whether lower emitting facilities were overly represented there, and that just simply doesn't seem to be the case. EPA does, of course, under Clean Air Act Section 114, have the authority to request certain information from sources. There is not, and petitioners don't cite any authority, but there isn't any practice or long-held procedure within EPA to do that, to issue Section 114 requests to an entire source category.
Why not?
For the purpose of doing
that. Why not? Then you avoid any arguments that you're being selective.
Well, EPA has typically been given very broad berth with regard to how much data is sufficient to make a decision in its expert judgment. And it gathers that data through generally available databases, which it has, like the National Emissions Inventory Database that was utilized here, which covered 226 out of the 238 facilities. There's Toxic Release Inventory Information, another database that EPA could consult.
You're telling me what you do. Why do you not use your authority, your full authority?
Well, there's certainly a burden associated with doing that. Some source categories have thousands of sources. This one has, you know, a couple hundred sources. It's a significant burden on the industry. It's a significant burden on EPA to do it that way. Here, EPA worked in concert with an industry group that had access to the
You mean it's cheaper for EPA to do it this way?
It's cheaper. It's more efficient. It's less burdensome for the industry in terms of responding. And here, and I think as we discussed in great detail in our brief, the data that were gathered were significant.
Remind me how the information for the NEI is assembled, the National Emissions Inventory. How's that assembled?
The National Emissions Inventory data comes from, I believe, a number of different sources. I think an important one is data reported from states, which then makes its way into EPA's database. And that data can be gathered through inventories that states perform, through submissions that are made by facilities. EPA has some of its own data that goes into the National Emissions Inventory. And the National Emissions Inventory, if I'm remembering correctly, it has some modeling of its own to sort of fill in the gaps of the data that it does have. Why it's not utilized here as the sole source of data is that for the purposes of a risk assessment, it doesn't break down the information sufficiently according to all the parameters that you would need to have to evaluate risk from a particular facility. It can give you an idea of general emissions. It can even allow you in some instances, as was done here, to break down which part of the facility an emission might have come from, but it doesn't tell you the distance to the fence line, the stack height, the release parameters. That was information that was gathered through the questionnaire that EPA worked with the American Chemistry Council to submit to its members. And so that's how that information was gathered. If the court has no further, well, wait one moment, please. I believe that's it. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have 3 minutes.
I'd like to address Government Counsel's benzene-NESHAP argument. In F2, there is a single reference to the benzene-NESHAP, the Federal Register publication citation in B. It appears next to the phrase as in effect before November 15, 1990. That phrase recurs in two parentheticals in A. We submit that phrase as in effect before November 15th, 1990, does not and cannot refer to the benzene-NESHAP because Congress instead used the Federal Register citation.
Even though everyone in Congress thought it did.
That is not what the statute says, and as Chief right. Judge Griffith points out, the legislative history here at best is...
Just Judge Griffith.
Judge Griffith today, that the legislative history is at best muddy due to the obligation to tighten standards when risk are greater than 1 in a million cited in our brief.
So what is the purpose of F2B then?
The purpose of F2B is to serve as a savings clause since it is a phrase in the negative. It is not an affirmative source of authority to EPA. The negative spaces of B cannot serve as affirmative authority. That is why EPA itself has to search in A for that affirmative authority.
It's adopting the administrator's interpretation in effect before November 15th.
It is saying that nothing shall be construed to affect that interpretation that was in effect in the benzene-NESHAP, but that is far from an affirmative grant of authority. EPA itself has to look to the parentheticals to find that authority.
An affirmative grant of authority. It's saying EPA. What was the way EPA looked at this before November 15th, 1990 is good law.
No, that's not what it says. It says it shall not be upended by Congress's adoption of A or any other section. But that does not provide an affirmative grant of authority
so
to an agency.
Is the benzene standards is red circled. It stays no matter what the statute does. That's your theory of that. What that means?
It stays in effect until EPA adopts standards under subsection 112.
Benzene is entirely different from everybody else.
That is correct. That's what Congress said. The parentheticals in A do not refer to the benzene-NESHAP. They do not. And the plain language of the statute, regardless of what the legislative history says, do not incorporate the benzene-NESHAP reference as the source of authority.
Well,
and indeed,
B?
The third
what about
sentence.
B?
Yes, Judge.
What about B?
It serves it. It is a prohibition. It is a savings clause. It is not a grant of authority.
Well, shouldn't you interpret the parenthetical in A as the same as B?
I interpret it the same as the phrase as in effect before November 15, 1990. At worst, that is ambiguous. At best, it is answered by the legislative history, which indicates that it preserved the judgment of the administrator, which was a phrase in the statute in Section 112 associated with the ample margin of safety standard.
The interpretation of this section, which is preserved.
That is correct, in the benzene-NESHAP. But that does not...
So the administrator's interpretation of the statute for benzene remains, but not for anything else.
Especially not for cancer, as in the one in
benzene
as the
is
one
cancer.
The 1 in 1 million standard in
benzene
A.
Benzene is a toxic.
It is indeed, but it does not govern the future establishment of standards for this source category or any other when the 1 in 1 million cancer threshold is exceeded. That is not present in A, where EPA's authority must reside.
Thank you very much. We have your argument.
Thank you.